For the 10 years that Scapatici was involved with the Norwegian squad from 1978 to 1989, there was 35 people killed under his watch in one form or another. Even when he was an informer, he'd have been the last person in the world you'd have thought was a British agent. But I'm certain, no, it's not as simple as that either. I'm quite certain that Freddie had a cast iron guarantee that no one in the Republic of Movement was going to touch him.
Thanks. Thanks very much for sitting down and joining me. But I appreciate it a lot. The book, for anyone who hasn't read the book, a fantastic read. Congrats on putting it together. Easily one of the best kind of troubles related books I've ever read. And usually, especially now with like an American audience, now I live over in America. If I was to recommend them a book about like Northern Ireland or the Troubles, I always tell them to read like a broader history first, and then if it's a book about a specific thing like agents, like Stake Number or something, I'd say to then read the specific one. But for this one, this actually emerges the two. It's by no means a history of the Troubles, but it does give you a very good context. This one actually would be a book I'd say you could read like standalone. Were you happy with the way the book came out?
I was, John. I don't think a reader's ever totally happy with a book, but I have to say, I was happy with this. Being such a controversial subject, you have to ask yourself, was it worth the hassle? Because it is hassle. And I have to say, it was. I'm happy that I've done it. I'm happy that I brought a bit of light to this subject, because the whole Scapatici thing, people thought they knew it. And I brought some light to it and some clarity, but not, I mean, whether anyone knows the whole Scapatici story is another matter. Not too sure Scapatici knew the whole Scapatici story, if I were to be honest. There's that much intrigue and there's that much skullduggery going on in the background, especially with Brits, with the tasking and coordinating groups, etc. You don't ever, and that's an umbrella group that ran all intelligence operations in the north. You never really get to the heart of it. You do to a point, and then they close shop. But I'm glad I wrote it.
But fantastic, yeah. Scapatici, for anyone who's read like biographies of like ex-IRA men and stuff, he has actually showed up in one or two. He showed up as an alias in Kevin Fulton's book. He was Michael in that book. He was named in Killing Rage by Eamon Collins. But your research went way, way beyond quoting a few books that he was in, and obviously there's a Steak Knife book written by Ingram and Harkin, but your research went far, far beyond that. Can you talk to me a little about like pulling the various sources of information, because there's such a wide ranging sources that this book is sourced from, you know?
Well, my approach to this was to talk to people who actually knew him, people who grew up with him, and people who were about him in the IRA, and who knew about him in the IRA. To me, that was the crucial element. And I was fortunate in that I knew, I'd introduced more than you to people from the markets area who had grown up with him, who knew the type of person he was, pre-Troubles. And that was very helpful. And then I also spoke to guys who had been involved with them in the Markets IRA. He lived in the Markets area of Belfast, in the Markets IRA unit. So that was helpful as well. I also spoke to former internees who had been interned with them. And I spoke to guys from various areas of the north who had dealings with him in his capacity as adjutant and OC of the Internal Security Unit, aka the Nutting Squad. So I spoke to that to me was the core sort of group that I needed to sort of, whose stories I needed to get to get, take it. I had to take this story away from previous books and general analysis and people saying things. There's a rumor that, and they said that. I had to get away from that. I had to get people with real stories who knew them. And that to me was the crucial element. After that, there, it was usually basic basic research that you do for any biography. Where did his parents come from? Where's his lineage? Where did his grandparents come from? What did they do for a living? What did he do for a living? Who was his wife? His children? What sort of relationship had he with his neighbors? All of that stuff. And then what did he do for a living? What did he do in the IRA? Et cetera, et cetera. And you build up the picture. But the core of the book is the testimony of the IRA volunteers and his neighbors from the market area.
I see. Okay, so Scaptici was born in Belfast in 1946. So just by coincidence of fate, like so many other men, he kind of came of age when the Troubles were kind of heating up, and then really began for real. I think he would have been like about 25. When they a little less when they kicked off properly. Your own joining of the IRA was around that time. Is there any sort of it's kind of interesting that the person who wrote the book has like a parallel somewhat in terms of their joining and their membership, you know?
Well, he was a lot older than me. I mean, when trouble started in 69, I was 15. I was doing A levels at school, and so I didn't. I came from a Republican background. My father was in the IRA, and so was all his brothers. So I came. I'd been sort of way brought up in a Republican environment, and when the Troubles kicked off, we lived down the Lower Falls. There was whole streets burning 150 yards from us. There was mothers with kids running up the street for their lives. And there was widespread shooting, principally from loyalists and from cops. I mean, the Beast Specials were the guys with the guns, and they didn't have any guns. They were doing all the shooting. That's why there was so many. It was four Catholics shot dead, including the 9-year-old kid that night. So initially, I mean, me gravitating towards the Provisional IRA at 15, 16, trying to get him when he was 16. And they wouldn't let me in, said I was too young. And I persisted, and eventually I got in, just turned 17, and I get in at 17. Scaptici didn't go to the IRA right away. The Provisionals didn't form until December 1970, and he joined them. He joined the unit in the markets area, and it wasn't long before he rose to the position of OC. He's a very strong, weak character. He had a presence about him. You know, he had a presence about him and an arrogance about him. And those are the type of things that naturally stick out and make one appear to be a natural leader. So no time at all he was OC. To cut a long story short, he was involved in operations in terms of putting bombs in the centre of Belfast, etc. And then on 9th of August 1971, when internment came out, he was arrested on the first roundup. So that's basically his pre internment sort of pedigree. And then he got out in 1984, March 84, and he was reinterned in September 84. But in between times, he had done a stint as the Brigade OC at Belfast. That's the top man in Belfast in the whole brigade. So he'd been Brigade OC, and he was reinterned, and he was released again in December when internment ended. He was there at the very start, he was there at the very end when internment ended in December 1975.
Funny, in the book as well, I didn't know this, but he actually could have been released a bit early from internment, but he refused to sign assign some documents saying that he would like stay away from the IRA and stuff. It actually, if you were to look at him at that time, you would probably think he was quite unlikely to become the probably the biggest rat in their history, right?
In Irish history, you're absolutely right, John. All he had to do was to sign a document disavowing the IRA and stating that he wouldn't go back, and he would have been released. And he didn't do it. And he could have done it. And it takes a strong person to say, "I can walk out that gate within the hour. All I have to do is just sign this bit of paper." Right? And he wouldn't sign the paper. He said, "You know what? Just keep me in." So you definitely would not have considered Freddie Scappaticci, even when he was an informer, he'd have been the last person in the world you'd have thought was a British agent. But certainly at the time you're talking about, you'd have said, "Here's one stanch guy."
Okay. What for you? We'll get into we'll get into like when he became an agent or an informant. But what for you is the difference between an informer and an agent? Because people, including myself, sometimes I'll kind of lazily kind of use the terms interchangeably, you know. But they're not quite the same term.
Well, I think an agent is far more senior than an informer. An informer could be the wee guy on the corner, right? Whose eyes and ears, but he's not involved in the organization, right? Now, informers can also be involved in the organization, but they wouldn't be in senior positions. Whereas an agent, by and large, is usually someone who's in a senior position within the movement and who can inform the British on major operations and stuff like that.
Okay, I gotcha. Would you say, for example, that like maybe like Robin Jackson was an agent as opposed to an informer? I mean,
Or,
I guess he wasn't an informer, but would you classify him as an agent just to
yes,
kind of test the definition?
absolutely. Jackson wasn't an informer. He was a British agent. He was actually a British assassin. But he was working hand in glove with the Glenarvan gang. He was working hand in glove with the Glenarvan gang. And murdering Catholics. He was an agent. He, informing wasn't wouldn't have been his thing.
Right, yeah, I was gonna say,
Sorry about that.
no worries, no worries. Okay, so a lot of this book focuses on a group within the IRA known as the ISU, the Internal Security Squad, or the Nutting Squad, more commonly known. Can you give us just for anyone who mightn't be familiar with the subject, can you give us an idea of just who they are, what they did, kind of to and from?
Yeah, the IRA up until 1977, the structure of the IRA had been basically modelled on that of the British Army, in that you had a brigade, battalion, and company structure in the big cities, and usually a battalion structure in the country areas, and leading Republicans, Fred and Hughes, Abra Bell, Gerry Adams came up with a different structure, which was an ASU structure, which was basically small units. The whole idea was that the security would be tighter. Small units that would be a group of operators.
Cells, yeah, the people call them cells.
Cell structure. And the idea, running in parallel with that, there was a feeling that you needed to have a more comprehensive security basis. And for that to happen, for that to work, you needed to set up an independent unit whose sole purpose was to ensure the security of the ASUs and the movement in general. And hence, we had the internal security unit set up. It was set up in 1878, and the first OC of it was a guy called Giorgio McGee, who had been previously a Marine, a Royal Marine, Special Boat Service soldier prior to the Troubles. And then he had joined the IRA when the Troubles started and had joined a company called D Company down in the Lower Falls. And he was the first OC, and Freddie Scapatici was his adjutant, that's his number two. And they picked their guys, they picked the people in the unit, mostly friends from the old D Company structure. And they then set about finding informers, finding people who were giving British information. And if they got them on tape admitting that they were helping the British state, they shot them dead. That was their remit. And that began in 1878.
Okay, and they were active up until when?
We were active right up until 1974, right up until the ceasefire in 1994. They were active the whole time. For the 10 years that Scapatici was involved with the Northern Squad from 1978 to 1989, there was 35 people killed under his watch in one form or another. So that's what you're talking about here. That's what we know of. That's what we know of.
Right, and it's funny because if they had had their way completely, Scapatici and his handlers, we would all still think that those 35 plus people were all informants. But in reality, not so clear.
Most definitely not. The bottom line of this was that this internal security unit tortured, physically tortured, and psychologically tortured those whom they wished to break. You have to remember, these guys were measured by how many people they killed. That was a measure of their success. So they did everything in their power. And if you read the book, there's a very telling indictment of them from a Republican called Paddy McDade, who was whose treatment at the hands of them, you wouldn't have got in a South American banana republic, and he was just one. They tortured people into making confessions, and then they used the confessions as a means to justify their murder. And God knows how many of those people were absolutely innocent, And we know that, for example, Michael Kearney was totally innocent.
Yeah, exactly. And Seamus, yeah, sorry, Seamus had to live, and his family had to live for years with the thought that my own brother was an informant until he was able to prove otherwise. But Seamus's case is very much an exception in that he was able to find evidence to clear his brother. Most people wouldn't have that luxury at all.
Well, there's Anthony Branagh as well from Ardoyne. He was shot dead by them, and he got an apology from the IRA. But you're absolutely right. What for Big Shimmy's intelligence? What for his determination? His brother would still be seen as an informer, and it's a tribute to him that he was like a hound dog to get to the truth, and he kept at it and kept at it. And he's a big friend of mine, and I think the word of him for it.
Yeah, me and him, for anyone who hasn't seen our episode, we spoke like in great detail. He was able to uncover an internal document that his brother had wrote, which had gone missing. It had fallen behind the fridge or something. And there was also he also alluded to a list that a list of names that Brendan Hughes wrote of informers within that squad, which he's since given to his lawyer Kevin Winters, who gave to Boucher in Canova. On that note, actually, it's very much, I think at this stage, it's very much accepted that it was by no means just Scapatici who was a rat in that squad. It went way beyond him.
Well, I'm always very careful. I have to say, John, I'm always very careful about calling people informers. Principally because I'm not always certain that the evidence is strong enough to call them. Not that I don't think they're informers. I think that unit was absolutely rat infested, if I were to tell the truth. But I'm just not, and I say so in the book, I have to be careful. I can't work. I never seen this note from Brenton's. And even if I had seen it, I would have to say, where did Brenton get the proof? Do you understand me? As an author, I have to be certain that the evidence that I'm putting in the print is right. And I'm just not, I'm fairly confident that if the dark put it in a down rating, it would be true. I have to be careful that I don't start calling people names that maybe at some future stage would be seen to be erroneous.
Of course, so much of the kind of dirty war, as it's called, it took place in the shadows. You know, oftentimes there just isn't documentation or tangible evidence to kind of prove this stuff. I was speaking to Anne Cadwalder, who wrote the Lethal Lies, and she made the exact same point about collusion. It's like so often there won't be a stamped document that says I colluded with whoever or I informed, and it just doesn't. So much of it exists in the shadows, you know.
Well, I'm sure there's somewhere where there's a stamped document, but it's an MI5 headquarters, and they're not going to let the likes of me in to have a wee look at it. You know, but Anne's absolutely right. Writers have to be careful that what they're putting down in print has a degree of backup. And I'm just not confident that the backup is basically strong enough to put in print.
Of course. Can you talk to us a little bit about, there was this game that would go on with like British handlers where they would treat their informers and their agents almost like a chessboard, so to speak. You might have, if you and me are both agents, and if I'm like a pawn, you know, I'm not that high up, but you're a bishop, so to speak, it's very much trading me for you. There was this game that went on. Can you tell us a little bit about that, like trading one high up informer for a not so high up informer?
Well, I have no proof of this, but that is a theory that has been knocking around for quite a while. Here's what you have to remember: this tasking and coordinating group that ran that collated all the intelligence in relation to all the intelligence that came up from the ranks of their agents and their informers, it all came to them, and they didn't make a decision and hardly action it. Now, the people whom the Nutting Squad were supposed to be killing were all allegedly informers. So if you take the alleged out and say they're all informers, then they're actually agents of the British state. They're working for the British state. And this prosecuting coordinating group, Scapatici, I have it from three very reputable sources, that Scapatici told his handlers about every one of the people who were going to get killed. And those three people, that came from Canova, from the Canova report. So they send it up to the tasking coordinating group. They're going to shoot Johnny Jenkins. And Johnny Jenkins is one of our lads. To hell with him. He has to go. It's more important that we keep Freddie in place. It's more important that we keep someone else in place. Tough shit. Johnny knows his score. And Johnny was the book. Johnny may have been a book private, may have been a volunteer, right? Freddie's number one, that's nearly four on. Freddie's number one in internal security. Freddie's vetting all new recruits. Before they even join the IRA or take the oath, they don't know who they are. Freddie's debriefing everybody coming out of Castlereagh. So he knows about every operation that's gone down. He knows who's on them. He knows what type of guns has been on them. He knows where the guns was kept. He knows everything. What's more important, keeping Johnny in place, who might be on the odd operation or might be at the odd gun match or whatever, or keeping Freddie in place? Johnny has to go. And that's the way they thought. Everything was thought out in terms of where's the benefit for us? And if their own people had to go, then so be it.
Again, this is something that's very tough to prove, but you spoke to people in the book who have alleged it, but how far up is it safe to say the knowledge of Steak Knife and what he was doing went? I think there's some who suggested that even up as high as the Prime Minister.
Well, it's again, it's speculation. It's difficult to say. The Tosking and Coordinating Group knew about Freddie. MI5 knew about Freddie. MI6 would have known about Freddie. Whitehall would have known about Freddie. Freddie was important. He wasn't your ordinary common 5'8", right? He was an important guy, and his reports on him and his activities would have been written out on a regular basis, and they would have been sent to Whitehall. So you must, and Thatcher knew what was going on. She knew that the Tosking and Coordinating Group were that members of the IRA, and for that matter, the UVF, etc., the loyalist groups, who were in the employ of the government, who were touts, right, were killing people out in operations. And she was told about this, and she said, just don't get caught, right? That was her attitude to the whole thing. Just don't get caught. It doesn't matter. The end justifies the means. So I would say without doubt that she was well aware of the name Freddie Scappaticci.
On that note, obviously Scappaticci is by far the biggest and most prolific informer or agent. Okay, yeah, exactly. That was my question. Do you think it's fair to say that, I'm sure there were others, do you think it's fair to say that he was definitely the crown jewel, that he was definitely the highest up, or could it possibly be that there were others? I'm sure there were others who weren't quite as valuable to them as Scappaticci was. But is there any possibility that he wasn't the number one?
He was the crown jewel for the British Army. Freddie was ran by the Force Research Unit, right? And he was their crown jewel. But I don't think Freddie was the highest informer in the IRA. I think there's at least one guy higher than Freddie who was involved, who was privy to operations, etc., and he was feeding the British information.
I see. You didn't. This isn't you making any implication. I'm not implying that you implied. But a lot of people, and it was discussed in the book. There are many who would accuse Martin McGuinness of working with British intelligence. There was someone quoted in your book. I believe it was one of the authors of the original Steak Knife book that he said Martin McGuinness wasn't with FRU. He was with the MI6. So within like within the IRA, is there like an average opinion in terms of whether McGuinness was informing in some way or wasn't?
Well, the person who made the quote you're talking about is a guy called Ian Hurst. Ian was a former Force Reaction Unit soldier, and he'd been involved in Derry, and he's absolutely adamant that Martin McGuinness was an MI6, had been an MI6 agent from the early 1970s. In the IRA, sorry?
From the 70s even, wow.
Yes, from the 1970s, MI6, and there had been the whole time. In the IRA, no one wants to believe that Martin McGuinness is an informer, right? It's almost too much to take. And I don't want to believe it either. It's the truth. Martin McGuinness was a man who who seem to be very strong. But the more some of the things that he did, the Franco Haggerty billing, for example, it's absolutely inexplicable. And it's difficult to not to look at that there and say there's something wrong here. But that's a long way from saying that he was an informer. I'm not too sure the evidence, there's enough evidence to say that Martin McGuinness was on the payroll of the British. I know what Ian's saying. Ian Hurst is a very, very decent, in my view, he's a British soldier, former British soldier, very decent, upright man who has no real, again, I don't see him having any agenda other than the truth. I'm just not sure that he's totally au fait with everything, right? But yeah, I don't want to believe that Martin McGuinness is an informer. That's even worse than Freddie Scabatici being an informer. I don't want to say that he was one either. Nobody, Jerry Adams has never talked about this. None of them have ever said Freddie's an informer and nothing else. There's a secret deal that's been done, in my view, that Freddie isn't to be touched.
Really, as part of like the Good Friday or something?
No. Freddie went down south on the run in 1989, January 1989, after the Sandy Lynch affair. Sandy Lynch was an informer, he was picked up by the IRA. The Brits hit the house and they rescued him. He was one of the ones they rescued. But Freddie had to go on the run for 2 years. When he came back, he was shunned by the IRA. He wasn't allowed back into the Nothing Squad. And his behaviour was totally bizarre. But there were IRA people who believed, Spike Murray for one, that he was at his lark and he was an informer. And, you know, and he got a bye ball, not even near him. Even when he was outed in 2003 in the press, he never budged. I mean, normally when that happens, the guy grabs his furniture and clears off the thing. And this guy didn't. This guy said, "Poop," said, "I'm not." He said, "You've got the wrong Scapatici. There's about 10 Freddie Scapaticis. You've got the wrong one. It's not me. Get the families together. I look them in the eye and I tell them, I never touched any of your sons or your daughters." And that was, and he was for sticking it. He was for sticking it out. And he was under no pressure from the IRA. They weren't saying a word about it. They were backing him up. In fact, they were saying that this was a bureaucrat plot to out this man, to destroy his reputation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, it would stay that way, except a journalist, a lady journalist in England called Sylvia Jones, put on the internet a tape in which Freddie was heard, a tape from 1983, in which Freddie was heard for the Cook Report, yes, that's it, in which Freddie was heard talking very loosely about the IRA, about Martin McGuinness and other people, and that was him. After that, there was nowhere for him to go except get on the boat and get out.
People are...
But for that tape, he'd have brass necked it, he'd have said tape, and he would just say it's not me.
This is a bit of an understatement considering his whole career and the fact that he stuck around after, but geez, what a pair of balls on him. I mean, my God, he had nerves of fucking steel, like, not to give credit where it's due, not that we'd be a fan of him or anything, but like, she's so...
I mean, it did take balls, but he had it. But I'm certain, no, it's not as simple as that either. I'm quite certain that Freddie had a cast iron guarantee that no one in the Republican movement was going to touch him, right? And I'm not just as certain, but I would be very surprised if Freddie didn't tell Lemons, "Guys, I have an insurance policy. I've got you. Taped and videoed. I can put you all away for a long, long time. If there's a her moved in my head, is there in trouble? And therein lies his confidence, because in the normal course of events, someone like him would have been shot dead like that.
I was going to say to have gotten, he literally now got through 3 decades of the trouble. He wasn't an agent or an informer for the whole thing, but to like so many agents and so many informers have met the same fate, which is a bullet in the back of the head, or if they're very, very lucky, exile. But he actually managed to play the game through to the very, very end and came out apparently with like over £1 million, possibly £2 million pound built up from all his deeds, you know.
Well, I reckon he got £1 million for informing, and he was a wealthy man in his own right. He had tax schemes and all, tax fraud schemes and stuff. He wasn't stuck for a few quid, and but going away to England was a bit of a wrench for him. He originally went to a relative in Manchester, and then he got a press embargo, a court and legal embargo that no one was allowed to photograph him, no one was allowed to say where he was living, and he literally disappeared off the radar for about 15 years. But he wasn't in good health. He had a couple of breakdowns, and I think he was very lonely. I mean, I get the impression, it's maybe I'm wrong, but I always, when I think of Freddie in the later years, I think of Osama bin Laden with an old blanket over his head and the remote control. You know, that's the sort of image I have of him. His wife would have visited him. Wife is a beautiful lady. And really, I mean, everyone I spoke to had nothing but the maximum praise for his wife. Says she was an absolutely beautiful, beautiful person. And she went over to him every 2 weeks to keep him company. I had the impression that in between times he's a very lonely guy, you know, and there's an irony in that, and that he had done all those things. He'd been involved in all those murders, and here he was, coming towards the last decade or so of his life, living wherever he was living, hiding, looking over his shoulder, right, worried, who's going to spot me? Because by that stage he was infamous, and he doesn't know if he's walking up the street or somebody on the other side that's from Belfast is going to recognize him and, or whatever. But I certain irony in having all that money and being absolutely miserable and alone. I could be wrong, but that's the impression I have of him.
Sure. What one of the things the books did that I'd never read in any other book about him or referencing him was yeah, we did get into like him as a man, his kind of his personality at times. One of them you kind of alluded to it there, where he had like very much like depressive episodes in his months or in his years, like months at a time. There was even there was even some information about like his kind of pornography habit, even back during the Troubles, when it was all like video, like actual, you needed like a physical video. There was apparently he had a big old collection, and then more recently he was even convicted of having like images of bestiality on his computer.
Well, he was. That was in 2017, and actually, it was the Canova team who raided his house, and they looked at his computers and stuff, and they found the 314 images of video, 314 video tapes, right? All of bestiality and pretty horrific stuff. But I never seen the tapes, but I have the copy of the charge sheet and what he was involved in. It's bloody horrendous. And I think it was. But anyway, he tried to say that he had no interest in bestiality. Just, yeah, that's typical Freddie. Don't admit nothing. Right? He went to his death, never admitting that he was a spy, that he was an agent. Admitted nothing. And that was the CRE training. CRE training was when you're arrested, you pick a spot in the wall and you keep looking at that spot and you don't talk. Right? And that was his IRA trainer, and that's he did that to the very end, and he never ever admitted being an a tight or whatever you want to call it, and that was him. And when in terms of the bestiality thing, he tried to say he was just looking at us, just looking at it. And, but I'm interested in girls with big breasts, and the cop says, "Well, there's no images of girls with big breasts on your computer. It's all animals." And it's again and again it's repeated. He couldn't get away. He got a minor fine, and that was it. But he wasn't Roy. He was a porn freak from an early age. He was cupboard full of porn.
Okay. Switching topics a bit. Okay. So to play devil's advocate, maybe just to make it interesting. I'm sure there would be some people who would say, like, look, cry me a river over what Scappaticci did, because most of the people he killed, whether they were labeled informants or not, they were still IRA members. And look, you live by the sword and you die by the sword, and you knew what you signed up for. And look, you signed up for a game where you can get killed, and you got killed. I not personally, not a view that I hold, but some would say that. What would you say to someone who would say, look, it's not even that big of a deal. It was just kind of terrorists killing other terrorists?
Well, that's the British Army's approach. That was what the MI5 man said to Keely. Keely was a guy from Uri, who was an ex-British soldier who infiltrated the Mutton Squad. And that's what they said to him. Well, who cares if it's only IRA people killing the IRA people? And people can have that attitude. See, at the end of the day, a lot of these guys who were killed, were not bad people. They didn't deserve to die. You know, none of them deserved to die. And none of them deserved to be tortured, right? There's a human rights issue here that supersedes everything. The IRA, and rightly so, has always been very strong on human rights abuses in relation to their own volunteers. And here they were practicing massive human rights abuses on people whom they hoped, they thought, might have been informers. And they mightn't have been informers. They mightn't even have been in the IRA. Half of them weren't in the IRA. Did those people deserve to be killed? I don't think so. And I think that this devil may care, they're all IRA people, doesn't stand up.
I was going to say as well, if you're the British Army or some member of British government, you're very much supposed to be like above these sort of paramilitary guerrillas who aren't paid by taxpayer, who aren't trained and who aren't working for government. You're not supposed to engage in illegal war practices like a group like the IRA can. You know, you're supposed to be, or you're supposed to be working for the government. You're supposed to be above that, you know.
Well, these guys, this task getting coordinating group, I keep coming back to them because they are so crucial to all of this. The IRA Army Council, in fact, thought they controlled this situation, that when someone was broken or someone made a statement admitting that they were working for the British, an army council member would have came and passed in the sentence of death on them, and they would have been taken out and shot there. But above that army council, there was another army council. They were the real army council, and that's this task and coordinating group. It was they who said who lived and who died, not these guys. These guys thought that they did. It was these guys here who really did. And the first and these guys would have told you, and they were cops. They were MI5. They were British soldiers, whose primary object was the preservation of law and order. First principle of policing is the preservation of life. And they were going out of their way to ensure that people were murdered. And they aided and abetted in murder. They aided and abetted in Michael Kearney's murder. They aided and abetted in Anthony Granite's murder, and God knows how many other innocent victims. But even if they weren't innocent, these guys aided and abetted in murder.
I was going to say, okay, so there were the IRA members that they killed when they didn't have to, when they shouldn't have. There's a lot more clear examples, like for example, it's strongly suggested that they may have known that one of their informants named Joe Fenton was about to get killed. They might have had bugs and recording that would tell their handlers that, but they let Fenton go on and be killed. There's also the Mahan family. Could you tell us a bit about them? Because this isn't exactly like an IRA active service member being stitched up. This is someone who wasn't involved anywhere near that degree.
This is a husband and wife. They were what was termed at the time 10-pound touts, right? They weren't a heavyweight. They were yesterday, they seen something, they'd have phoned it in, right? But that's all they would have done. They weren't involved in the IRA. They weren't even particularly noted to have IRA sympathies. But Joe Fenton was a strange case. Joe was caught with explosives and brought into the cop shop. The cops, Bishop Rand said to him, "You have two choices, either you work for us and we let you go on and deliver the explosives to wherever you go to and nobody will be any the wiser, or you don't work for us, in which case we charge you and you'll get 15 years in jail." So he took the first option, right? I'll work for you. But he didn't want to work for him. And he got his family together and they went to the Australian embassy and they applied as a family to move to Australia to live. And Joe had a clean record and they were going to let him go. Students were going to let him come in. And then the branch stepped into the thing and said to the Australians, "This guy's Irish. You can't let him in." So they didn't let him in. Joe came back. It was in Northern Ireland, right? And he was straight back and they had him back working for them, right? And they wouldn't let the guy go. Guy was very reluctant. I mean, again, blackmail, it's always blackmail. Blackmailed into working for them, and she's working away for them, and the heat's coming on. And somehow or another, he finds out about the Mahans. So he directs the IRA to the Mahans, and they're shot dead, right? And Joe's seen as a bit of a wonderful guy because he was able to help out in this way. This is all filthy. And then Brendan Hughes was very, the dark was very suspicious of him. And he's eventually picked up. Brendan was the director of intelligence for the whole IRA. GHQ, director of intelligence, he's on the Army Council as well. And the dark was very suspicious of him. Joe's picked up by Freddie. Freddie's very heavily involved in his interrogation. Freddie's phoning the Sanders. "This guy's going to get whacked here. If you just don't call me, I'm telling you now, he's going to get whacked." And then somewhere along the lane, it's a realization that, no, he's not getting whacked. He's going to get taken down south, right? And they're going to debrief him proper, and he knows everything. He was an important agent, as he was involved with the OC of Belfast. And the OC of Belfast wasn't an agent, but he was naive, right? And he was backing this guy up, Joe, and Joe broke, and Joe told some stuff. But the idea was, rather than take him down south anyway, a debrief and find out everything that he knows. And on the way out the door, he was shot dead. Somebody said he tried to make a run for it, right? Another guy says, no, he wasn't. The guy just pulled out the shooter and shot him. Pulled the gun out and shot him. And so there was a hue and cry. Why was he shot? The dark was squealing the place out. Why was this man shot? I wanted them down south. I needed to question him. And there was a suspicion that he was shot to make sure that he didn't get down south, but he knew too much. So that's the Joe Fenton story. But at the back of it all was a very frightened guy who didn't want to be doing what he was doing and who'd been blackmailed in the Vice Branch. And at the back of all of that, you had the tasking and coordinating group who knew what house he was in, who could have intervened and saved his life, but didn't.
You alluded to something very true there, like a lot of people are turned informants. It's not even as if they have some desire to work with the British government or anything. They just get oftentimes you're dealing with working class people who, you know, who aren't rolling in money. So if you can blackmail them in some way, or if you can even blackmail them and then pay them like a small bit of money could go a long way. Now, this very much wasn't the case, or it's certainly believed it wasn't the case with Scappaticci. He was I think it's believed, and it was at least in the first Steak Knife book, was that he was a walk-in. Can you tell us a bit about how Steak Knife came to be an informant, and how much we even know about it?
Well, that's one of the big conundrums. There's about six or seven different theories as to how he ended up an agent. One is that he was a walk-in. I don't believe for one second Freddy was a walk-in. Not for a second. Freddy was ideologically committed Republican. Certainly he was up until he was released from retirement. And I can't see him changing that much. I don't think he was a walk-in. I don't think he was. There was talk that he was involved in a fight, and he walked in and offered his services to the British, but fight with two IRA men, and offered his service to the British to get back at them. I don't think that's the case. There are two possibilities, as I see it. One is that he was going to get serious time for the tax scam that he'd been involved in for years, right? He could have got up to 8 years there because other people were getting 8 years, right? And he's only after doing quite a long stretch for internment for someone who was never charged. He'd done 3.5 years or something. Never charged with anything. So the possibility of doing an 8 stretch might have exercised him, to say the least. The other possibility was that he was done, and this is a rumor, but it's a rumor only. There's a rumor that he was arrested and charged with having sex with an underage person. Now, that is rumor. And again, there's no evidence whatsoever to back it up. But were that to be the case, that would be a very credible reason for him to turn. Whatever turned Freddie, it was something that materially injured him personally, right? It would have been blackmail. It would have been something that was so horrendous that he believed to be so horrendous, the alternative was to work for the Brits. That's the way I see it.
Interesting. Yeah, I did. That did shock me when I saw the allegation in the book that he had. I think I can't remember the exact quote, but someone even said that they were passing in the car and he'd be making comments about like teenage girls and stuff, kind of unsettling stuff, you know?
Well, that's only one thing. There's other stuff that you haven't put in, simply because there's no evidence of it at all. The one that you're talking about, there's a bit of evidence for it, so that's why I put it in. But even at that is not hard and fast to say that he had a sexual sort of deviance in terms of underage kids. I'm just mentioning that it has been said to me that he had a preference for underage girls.
We sort of touched on it earlier, but once you get accused of being an informant and get like arrested and questioned, a lot of them are stuck in a really tricky situation where like they know they're gonna get tortured until they say something. So like if you torture someone long enough, they tell you they shot Michael Collins, like you know what
well,
I mean?
That's right. Don't tell you anything. Someone's tortured to the point where they're ready to break, they will say what you want them to say. And if you want them to say you were involved in a sample, you give the top 10 years, you said. I mean, the torture of Paddy McDade, I mean, it was horrendous. I mean, that guy was forced to urinate, defecate inside a sleeping bag for 3 days. And used as an ice tray, stood all over his face, stood all over his genitals, lifted them above their heads, clapped them on a concrete floor. Heavy stuff. Like the stuff you'd see the Nazis doing. That's in the area of the Nazis. These boys was out of control. This wasn't typical of the IRA. These boys was a law unto themselves.
Was there some, obviously it's quite a project to put together this book. It must have, God knows how many headaches and late nights and frustration and so on. But in terms of your motivation for it, like, is any part of you, given that you were a member and that there was such a prominent reform, was there any part of you that kind of has like an itch that you needed to scratch with getting to the bottom of Scapatici and at least making it public about him?
Well, there was. I mean, I have always thought that Scapatici was barely scratched. The surface of the Scapatici story had been barely touched, and that there was real dirty dealings going on. And I had always a suspicion. Here's the thing. Here's what motivated me more than anything. Scapatici was a British agent. Right? And I suspect, and I've always suspected, somebody said to me, how do you know he always passed the names and stuff up the stairs? And my answer to this was an earlier interview last week. There's no way, would the Brits say, you can pick and choose what information you want to give us. Right? No intelligence agency would allow that. Right? Stadium, you tell us everything, Doyle. Don't you even think of hiding anything from us, right? So he told his handlers everything. And out of all of the Scapatici, right from he was exposed in 2003, right up and virtually until my book, this tasking and coordinating group have been hiding in full view. And nobody's ever heard of them. He asked the leading journalist last week. Lady journalist, and I says, what about the task and coordinating group? And she says, who are they?
I didn't know before reading your book, and I consider myself more knowledgeable than most, yeah.
Yeah, and these guys are hiding the place on TV. They're on TV giving analysis, giving opinions on this and that and the other. And these are the boys that sat there on the Monday morning smoking or whatever they're doing and said, let him go. He's going to get shot there. Oh, well, every snooker match over in the club or whatever. That was part of the principal reason why, one of the big principal reasons why I thought this book needed to be written.
One of there was another kind of allegation you addressed in your book, and again it was something that I read in the Ingram Harkin steak knife book. This isn't about steak knife, but more the FRU. They said that that the FRU at one stage actually might have saved Gerry Adams' life. And what they said happened was that they found out on an attempt that was going to be made on his life, and then they found out where the guns were found, or the guns were hid, rather. They went and fiddled around with them to reduce the capacity of it, and then, which possibly may have saved his life, considering he did get shot, not to the head. But into the body, and that, and you know, he might have been saved by the fact that his gun was jarked, as they say. Do you personally believe that?
I don't know. In the book, they say, whether or not there was full, the rounds had a full, were fully loaded with the PET, I don't think you call it. That's the stuff that makes the bullet fire. It's like explosives. A tiny bit of it. Whether I was full of that or whether I was only half, one of the bullets had to hit Gerry Adams in the head. He may have been dead. I mean, it was pretty risky business to say, we'll only put half of it in and hopefully he won't be hit in the head. It's something that, I mean, things are capable of running. You know, they live in this dark world, and I don't know. It just seems a bit far-fetched to me.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
It definitely stood out in my mind because of the bizarreness of it. Like, yeah, and the fact it illustrates an interesting position the handlers would be in. And you alluded to it in the book. There was a movie called The Imitation Game, and there's a part when they crack the code, and then they realize that they're in a position where they can't go saving everyone. That they find out through their cracking of the code, because if they do, it'll just be so obvious. And the British handlers were playing the same game.
In 1986, an order came from the Army Council. There was a few IRA operations that were very bad. People were getting hurt, the civilians, etc. And the Army Council decided all operations had to be vetted by the OC Northern Command, who was Martin McGuinness. So rather, I mean, that's a big task. So we delegated the Belfast setting to the Northern Squad, the OC of which was really Scabatice. So, in actual fact, the British Army, the Tasking and Coordinating Group, had the rate of veto in Belfast over operations, which meant all IRA operations had to go through the British Army. It's crazy.
Mad altogether. Yeah, I actually didn't know that until reading the book that the ISU had like you said, veto power over operations. I didn't know they were quite that powerful.
Well, Freddie was still, as I keep saying, Freddie was highly respected, right? And it was Martin McGuinness that given the nod anyway to say it's been through ISU, and he was controlling, which meant that the Brits were controlling all that.
I'll leave it to people to read the book to actually get his whole kind of story. Excellently done, like I said. But one of the fascinating parts of it was when it was towards the end of his time in the IRA. He wasn't like out completely or officially, but he was kind of being ostracized. He was being marginalized somewhat within the movement. And there's a quote from a criminologist who says that when people like him who kind of lose power, they'll often start like flailing, they'll throw like a bit of a temper tantrum in an attempt to, I don't know, maybe just strike back or get a bit of power back. And you mentioned it briefly, but he spoke to a television show which was out at the time called The Cook Report. Can you tell us a bit about that? The timing of it's very interesting that he decided to kind of kick out around that time.
This was after he came back in 1981, and he was in charge with the Sandy Lynch affair, which was inexplicable because he had a finger, his fingerprint was found on the battery of the security buzzer they used to see if a suspect was carrying a bug. His fingerprint was caught on inside the device that was used to buzz them down. It was caught in the room where Sandy Lynch was held. So that put Freddie right in the room. And there's a whole rigmarole, and he came up with this bizarre story that he was doing work for a lady who lived the very house that Lynch was held. He'd been doing electrical work on it. Madness, pardon me for question. Harry got away, but it was madness. And also, Sandy Lynch said he knew Scabatici's voice. And the guy who owned the house made a statement to the police saying that Scabatici had been the leading guy. So he got out, and he wasn't dark-roomed. But we said to him, "Freddie, how did you get out in the face of such strong evidence?" But he got out anyway. But he was out of the IRA, to my knowledge. And he was ostracized in the sense that he was no longer furnished with the information that he had been used to. He was outside the circle, right? He wasn't being told what the Northern Squad was up to, who the new recruits were. He wasn't vetting anyone coming out of the barracks, etc. He was isolated. And for a guy like this, who had been very regimented all his life, this guy liked to work. He used to go to work in the mornings. He just sent his workers to work, and he'd done a bit of the bricklayer, done a bit of bricking himself. He'd had his day ordered. It would be one of the day would have been. He didn't know where he was, and maybe usually done his IRA stuff. All of a sudden, he's out of the loop. He doesn't know what's happening. He's not knocking around the IRA people. And he starts behaving bizarrely. He asked, as you said, he asked to see the GOC, a guy called General Wolseley. And he asked for an assurance that he's still important, that he's still as important now as he was before Sandy Vince came on. Says, you're the jewel in the crown. He wasn't the jewel in the crown by then because he didn't have the information, didn't have access to the information that he once had. So after that door, he goes to a guy, he goes to the Cook Report. The Cook Report run a 2-week series on Martin McGuinness, say he was the biggest terrorist in Ireland, etc., etc. McGuinness didn't cooperate, of course. But Gary watched it, and then at the end of the second series, he phoned him up in Manchester, the Granada TV, and says, "What Ed McGuinness stuff you put on his off balls?" Man says, "Who are you?" He says, "Look, I'm someone who knows about these things." So there, he convinces them that he's real McCoy. He meets them in the Culloden Hotel that night. This is in 1983. He meets a guy called Dan Twistle. He meets Sylvia Jones and another guy. And they put the tapes on, and he tells them about Martin McGuinness, that Martin McGuinness is the guy who gives them the nod for all the Luton squad killings. And he talks about the English department. Well, that is pretty... that anyone would talk about something like that. And it's very loose, and it's very, very bad. So he tells them all that. And then after that, there are about a year, maybe 6 months later, he goes to... not too quickly there. In the meantime, the branch find out that Freddie's in the car park talking to these reporters. They grab one of the reporters, Sylvia Jones, and they say, "He is far too important. You can't publish this because he'd be dead by the weekend, right? And the other people dead as well." So they agree to hold back on it, but she takes it. She has the recording, and then Freddie goes to a member of a father whose son was shot dead, and tells him, "I was there when your son was shot. If he had to shot him in the neck, and I told him to shoot him in the head, punish him well. Took a lot out of his misery, so he's doing a great favor." This is all very bizarre behavior, right? By any stretch of the imagination, this isn't the British Gabbagichi, British Sandy Lynch. Never got up to half of this stuff. And that, hence my view that he was off the rails. He wasn't thinking things out. He was trying to etch out a room for himself, maybe trying to ingratiate himself with the IRA again, who don't seem to have had any interest in him. But he seemed to be off the rails. And the interesting thing is that Sylvia Jones, the girl who recorded him, was the one who finally broke him. She broke him. She was the one in 1984 who released the tape. And there was no escaping. There was no more bullshit. Very cheap. And then that's when he took off.
Right. Yeah, it was a very interesting piece of information. It was kind of an insight into him. Yeah, this tantrum he threw after he wasn't so important anymore.
Yeah. Well, the analyst was able to work all that out.
I won't keep you. I won't keep you too much longer. Obviously, Freddie Scappaticci died not too long ago. And there's some who would say, there's some who would say, "Oh, yeah, we haven't seen the body. We don't really know." Your own personal view, is he no longer with us?
I don't think he's got this anymore. I think he is dead. I knew that he was in bad health. He was living in Guildford. In 2017, and he had a massive heart attack then, And he's been in bad health for the last, ever since he left the North. Ever since he went away, he'd been in bad health, he'd been having strokes, etc. So when I say that I have this image of him with Bin Laden with a blanket over the head in the remote, that's the image that I have of him. Maybe I'm wrong, but he's been in bad health, so I wouldn't be at all surprised if he is dead. Same time, I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't dead. But he was there on Bondi Beach with the cool posters. Wouldn't surprise me either.
I was going to say, if I was more conspiratorial minded, I would say, wow, this is great timing that he died just before Canova. Isn't that funny? No, I don't think that. I think he is perfectly reasonable age.
How do we know he wasn't given a Mickey Finn? How do we know somebody didn't put something in his tea and give him a wee push along the way? When Freddie died, Canova collapsed. Any chance of convictions collapsed?
Interesting. I was going to ask it that as my final question. Any Canova has been, I think it's been put back. Its release has been put back quite a number of times, and the book goes into detail about it. But what do you expect when we do soon eventually get? I mean, we're recording this on September 25th, so I mean it shouldn't be too long. What are you expecting from it?
3 weeks. They reckon that Canova will be out in 3 weeks. There's different reports. I have heard a report from a guy who said that he read it. And this guy said that it's very, very critical of the security services. Right? So I'm anticipating that it will say what I said. It said in the book that Scappaticci told the security services about every killing in which he was involved. And by and large, they sat by and let those killings occur. So they aided in the battle in the murder of British Irish citizens. That's what I think Canova's gonna say.
Do you expect I was talking about this with Seamus kind of briefly, and we both kind of came to a similar ish, although he was to be honest, he was saying he does have some optimism, and he was saying he hopes that Boucher treats this. I believe the way he said it was, I hope he treats this as a vocation, not just like a 9-to-5 job, you know, that he treats it like a proper investigation. I personally don't think, I'd be shocked if anything was in it that would actually lead to kind of concrete actions being taken or someone having to be convicted or so on. Would you agree? Do you think,
yeah,
in my opinion, it won't get released if it actually puts someone in it?
I have been saying from my start of this book that this legacy bill has more to do with the potential for charges in the future than it has in the past. The legacy bill, in my view, was never about some wee farmer getting shot in the back 15 years ago. The legacy bill for me was about the TCGs, about the potential that these guys would be hauled before the courts and charged with murder type offences, i.e. aiding and abetting murder or facilitating murder or whatever, right? My view was that this was about saving them. And you touched on it. Freddie Scappaticci dies in April this year, right? And when he dies, there was 19 feds sent to the public prosecution service in which Freddie Scappaticci was accused of murder in one form or another. Those feds were 9-0 and void, because he's no longer there to defend them. Right? If Freddie Scappaticci had been called before court, he might have given evidence. He probably wouldn't have, but he might have. That wasn't going to happen either. So what are we left with? Right? All that we're left with is the trail that Big Jimmy talked about, the Mazer trail, right? And the good thing about it was that Boucher was able to access MI5 feds. And if nothing else comes out of Boucher, other than the fact that Scappaticci told his honours about every killing, then that's a major victory, because then we know that the British state, they're ready, admitted these killings. It's not as if you're willing to prove against them. They proudly boasted to shed these guys, right? But the other end of it is, if it's proven that this trail, well, it started with Freddie Scapatici to his family, to his boss, and his made up to his task and coordinating group, that these guys knew 35 times at least beforehand that someone was going to be murdered, and that these guys could have sent in the troops to save the suspect's life and didn't do it, then we're into a new realm. And the possibilities that opens up. I was actually talking to a lawyer the other night, and it could be a bloodbath. I mean, not a bloodbath in terms of real blood, but this isn't over. It's not going to be over with Canova. I mean, if you're a family member and you know that the forces of law and order could have saved your son and didn't, you're going to want to know, why didn't you? And why is this man not being charged? This is a process. It could be a bloodbath.
Yeah, I hope. Look, I really do hope that like the handlers and the higher ups in question, I don't know, at least get kind of named and shamed, if not prosecuted. But I think it'd be fair to say, like, are we long past the time when anyone will actually be like prosecuted? Let's say they actually got like steak knife handlers. Would I be right in saying like it's probably way past the point where they'd be actually convicted or something?
I don't know. The legacy bill is going to negate all of that, I think. The best that could probably happen would be to take civil cases against the Ministry of Defence, the relatives. But in a civil case, everything comes out anyway. It's as good as an open court. All evidence has to be presented. So I think that would probably be the way the lawyers will go.
Thank you very much now for all your time.
You're welcome.
Very much appreciated. I was going to say, anyone now, if you're familiar with Northern Ireland's history and the Troubles, it's an excellent book to read. If you haven't read a single thing about it, then it's also a good place to start, because the book gives you a bit of context. The book just isn't specifically about this one thing. It is mainly, but it does give you a wider context. On that note, is there anything you want to leave us with there? Any final thoughts?
No, John. Thank you so much. Very informative, and you're well tuned in. I'm very, very happy with this interview.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. We might even speak again after Canova comes out, or more information comes out in the future.
Absolutely. But Canova's going to be huge. So if you need me, give me a shout.